Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new campaign aims to promote breastfeeding for African-American moms in Wisconsin and to reduce the infant mortality rate for black children. First, most of the state is getting a late dose of winter today as a major snowstorm moves across Wisconsin. Nearly a foot of heavy, wet snow was expected to fall over parts of central Wisconsin, and people in northern and southern parts of the state are getting some snow, too. Dozens of schools canceled classes today or let students out early, and it remains to be seen if this weather will affect voter turnout on this election day. In case you've forgotten, spring officially arrived 2 weeks ago. What can we expect for the duration of the storm? What's to come once it leaves? And how unusual is it to have this much snow this late in the season? Jeff Last is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Green Bay. Jeff, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Was the worst over with yet, Jeff? Or are we still seeing lots of snow in parts of the state?
No, there's quite a bit more to come here. The snow band kind of set up where we expected from near La Crosse up to just north of Green Bay, where as much as 4 to 6 inches has fallen in that area, with another several inches can be expected here as we go into the late afternoon and evening hours.
And parts of the state got some snow already, a good chunk of snow over the weekend, right?
Yeah, this is the second system that we've had here in the last week or so. We had a moderate snowfall across parts of northern and central Wisconsin earlier in the weekend, as you mentioned. This one will be a bit bigger and more widespread.
And give us the meteorology here. What's making this snow happen?
Well, you know, we're in a time of year now where the clash of the air masses occurs. The warm, moist air from the south is trying to move, you know, into the Midwest, having some trouble, as we all know too well. And that cold Canadian air still wants to hang on across the Great Lakes and Wisconsin. So when you get that clash of air masses, energy forms and moves along that temperature difference, and that produces those low pressure systems, which can produce the snowfall even in the springtime.
And this is wet, heavy, messy stuff, right?
Yeah, it is. Temperatures are around freezing, so as it started to fall, it was melting on many of the roadways. But now, as the precipitation intensity or snowfall intensity has picked up, we are seeing accumulations on the roadways and slippery travel conditions reported.
And how long is it going to be potentially hazardous for, especially that central Wisconsin over to where you are in Green Bay?
Well, as the temperatures fall during the evening hours, as the sun sets, the temperatures will fall, and the accumulations, I think, will pick up. So the afternoon and evening commute will be pretty treacherous across much of central and northeast Wisconsin.
It sounds like tomorrow morning could be an issue in some places, too.
Yeah, it could be. As temperatures fall below as they fall well below freezing, I think we'll see some icy spots on the roadways, even for the Wednesday morning commute.
Jeff Last is with us from the National Weather Service. He's based in Green Bay. We're talking about the winter weather on this spring day. And, Jeff, if this snowstorm, I'll be honest with you, happened December or February, we're probably not giving you a call. It's April. Is this unusual, this much snow this time of year?
No, I wouldn't say it's too unusual. I think as I look back in the records, we probably have a snowstorm this large every 2 to 4 years somewhere in Wisconsin. So not unusual, but certainly we don't see it every year. I don't think we'll set any records as far as the biggest April snowfall anywhere in the state. But certainly it's enough to cause slowdowns on the roads and some inconveniences.
And, Jeff, I know you're a meteorologist, not a psychologist, but as part of the what makes it seem weird is kind of our expectation game, where I think I've talked to a lot of people. They're eager for something that looks like spring. There's an expectation game here that's making it seem more significant.
Well, yeah, I think that's correct. And so far this spring, it's been pretty cool. Even without the snow, we've had kind of a cold, cloudy spring. So I think people are ready, even though this winter, quite frankly, hasn't been that bad. Overall, I'd say most parts of Wisconsin have had snowfall that has ended up underneath the long-term average. So this, I think, will melt quickly, as April snowfalls usually do, and we'll see temperatures in the 50s, probably within 10 days.
Yeah, what is the rest of April looking like from what we know so far?
Well, I think once we get through the next 6 or 7 days, probably by the time we get to mid to late next week, we'll see a pretty good chance of temperatures in the 50s across, at least across the southern half of Wisconsin, away from Lake Michigan. I think as we get into the third and fourth week of April into May, I would imagine we're going to see more temperatures that'll be close to and perhaps even above average, certainly more frequently than we've seen so far this early spring.
Now, I hate to bring this up as people are getting ready to shovel, but next week, Jeff, is Tornado and Severe Weather Awareness Week here in Wisconsin. April is when the tornado chances, I was looking at a chart, this isn't peak month, but this is when we got to start thinking about them, right?
Exactly. The time to prepare is before the severe weather hits, and that's why we talk about the Tornado Awareness Week in April. It's kind of hard to think about it now, but soon we're going to have those warm temperatures that are trying to get up here, that's always a dangerous mix when the Canadian air is slow to move away, and that clash of air masses moves farther north, and we're in the bullseye for severe storms and tornadoes.
And I know, you know, with hurricane season, they try to predict whether it's going to be a big year for hurricanes or it's not. And I know that's hard to do. Do we do anything like that for tornadoes, or are those too random isn't the right word, but too unpredictable to predict?
Yeah, it's much more difficult to forecast the number of and intensity of storms. Perhaps 2 or 3 days ahead of the time, but certainly not a season ahead. It's not really easy to say how this severe weather season will go. Last year we had 23 tornadoes in the state, which is about average. They can happen up here. We've seen big tornadoes over the course of the years, and everyone needs to be prepared before the storms hit.
Now, moving back away from tornadoes to snow, is this probably the last significant snow we're going to see this month?
I don't know if I would say that quite yet. we are in this active weather pattern, and we've got a couple of systems that are, you know, they'll be affecting us here in the next 3 to 5 days. But I would say, if I had a bet, yes, it probably is the last big storm. But certainly, it might not be the last time we'll have to shovel, especially, you know, as you go farther into the northwest part of the state.
And once again, remind us what we're expecting as we go through the evening with this snow, in where it's most the heaviest in central Wisconsin and north and south of that as well.
Yeah, it looks like right now I would expect another 2 to 4 inches of snow in the west central part of the state, and as much as 4 to 7 inches additional in the northeast. North of that, say in the far northwest part of the state, just light snow and flurries, maybe up to an inch. And across the south, say Madison to Milwaukee, an inch or two of snow. Although it is raining right now in Milwaukee, colder air will move in, and there could be about an inch in Milwaukee as well.
We'll leave it there. Jeff, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks. No problem, and I appreciate talking to you.
That's Jeff Last, Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Green Bay. He joined us to talk about this late-ish season snowstorm hitting Wisconsin. Right now, African-American moms in Wisconsin are less likely to breastfeed their children than are white moms. The state also has one of the nation's highest racial gaps in infant mortality, the death of a child during their first year of life. Dane County is not an exception to that rule. Just last week, several Madison groups launched a breastfeeding awareness campaign. It seeks to educate women of color and those working in healthcare about the benefits of breastfeeding. Tia Murray and Tamara N. Thompson are doulas, lactation counselors, and the co-founders of Harambe Village, an organization that provides support to women during the childbearing process. Tia, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
And Tamara, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Tia, let's start with what you're trying to address. What are the problems that you're seeing out there?
Sure. So we all are aware that breastfeeding has great benefits, but many mothers aren't aware that they have a choice to breastfeed, or aren't aware that they are consumers and that they need to have access to that education and information. So what we're trying to do is raise more awareness on an individual level about the benefits of breastfeeding in the context of disparities, but also raise larger level community awareness and get buy-in from our institutions and providers to understand the importance of breastfeeding when we talk about racial disparities.
Yeah, and And Tamara, this isn't just an effort to reach out to the moms themselves, but to healthcare providers. What are you hoping they take out of this message?
Absolutely. I'm hoping that they take away from this the different and many ways that on an institutional level, on a societal level, all of the things that tend to undermine the natural relationships between mothers and their babies. When we understand those things, we can uncover a lot.
And Tia, what do we see in healthcare settings sometimes? Are women counseled differently based on their race when it comes to things like breastfeeding?
So what we're seeing, it's not necessarily explicit difference mm-hmm. in what we're saying. I think a lot of the times it's what's being left out or what's not being said. And although we have research demonstrating that we have great disparity in the quality of care given between our racial counterparts, but we've also seen in our anecdotal work the difference in the information that's provided or the extent to which we provide information for that particular person to make an informed choice.
And Tamara, what kind of information are you hoping that, I guess, all moms have?
Absolutely. For the most part, we want people to understand the natural process, things that are absolutely normal and things to expect. Sometimes people go into their experiences with unrealistic expectations or thinking that myths are real things. So dispelling those things, giving real, accurate information and hands-on practical expertise to a person and inform them before their baby arrives, just increase the chances.
And let's, you mentioned, Tia, the benefits of breastfeeding. Can you amplify those a little bit? Talk about the kind of health differences breastfeeding can make.
Absolutely. And what I'd like to do is talk about them in the context of the work that we do with racial disparities. So we know that we have great disparity in infant mortality. And what's driving that is preterm birth. And we also know that a lot of our babies in African-American community are dying from SIDS. Now, coupled with that, we know that breastfeeding, when you have a baby prematurely, your body makes extra special breast milk. So we can save babies' lives. In addition to that, we also know that we have great disparity in other health outcomes in the community. So there's benefits for mom and babies to decrease chronic diseases, reproductive cancers. When we talk about infant mental health and attachment, breastfeeding enhances that as well. And so there's so many benefits that really can save babies' lives and really lay a foundation for long-term health for both the breastfeeding person and the baby.
Talking to Tia Murray and Tamara Ann Thompson, they are co-founders of Harambe Village. That's an organization providing support to women during the childbearing process. We're talking about an outreach effort to encourage women of color to breastfeed their children and healthcare institutions to give good advice and good support. And Tamara, let's talk about how this is going to work. What are you going to do on a practical level in this outreach?
On a practical level, we want to be able to dispatch more people to give more information. We want to have more people that are in different neighborhoods, that are in living rooms instead of clinical settings, that are giving one-on-one support. On a broader level, we want people who work in clinics to be able to have more of a nuanced approach to how they provide breastfeeding support. We also want people who work in hospital settings and also pediatricians to be able to have accurate and sound information that's backed by what we know for sure.
And Tia, Tamara mentioned having people going out and doing visits. Talk about how that would work and what kind of information would be passed on.
Absolutely. So what we do as doulas is we provide that information education via home visits. So part of our work is home visitation work. And we are training other doulas who are from the community or previous clients of ours who want to be able to go out and dispatch that information to other women, other families, other fathers. We also have a fatherhood initiative. So our fathers are engaging other fathers to talk about breastfeeding and what that looks like for them. So really training and empowering community members to buy in and take a role in mobilizing the rest of the community around that.
So am I hearing you right? New moms would kind of graduate from this and say, hey, I want to help other people too?
Absolutely. We've had several moms that we've worked with that have told us they felt so empowered that they want to in turn become doulas themselves and they want to help other women feel just as empowered. So we're absolutely seeing that happen.
Mm-hmm. Tamara, let's talk about the support side of this because I imagine for a woman, any woman going through pregnancy, it can be isolating if you don't have someone around you who's been through it. Is that, I guess, that social connection part of the goal here?
Yeah, when we see enhanced and quality relationships, we see enhanced and quality outcomes. So when we have someone that's paired with a knowledgeable, patient, compassionate person through the entire process, we're able to see a better understanding and quality of the care after the person has had their baby and after the person has been able to kind of, you know, decompress and understand what has happened. They feel much more satisfied with their experience versus a person who didn't have that continuous ongoing support.
Tia, can you talk about the history of what led you to do this effort, Harambe Village? There's been something like this before. It kind of went, and now you're bringing it back, right?
Absolutely, Rob. Back in the day, the Harambe Family Enhancement Center existed on the south side of Madison, and it was a very comprehensive one-stop shop, and the model was so unique that there were people coming internationally to see what we did there and how it worked. My mother worked there, and I grew up as a child in that center, but what's interesting is in about 2007, we saw the deepest decline in black infant mortality that we've ever seen in this county. And it made national news because it has not happened anywhere else. And when that center closed in 2010, we saw that spike go right back up. So we know because we benefited from that center as young mothers who were breastfeeding our babies.
That's right.
We know the benefit of that work and that model, and we wanted to bring that back with a maternal child health focus. And we were sick of talking about disparities, and we wanted to do something about it.
And Tamara, you reached out to other organizations, healthcare providers. Are people enthusiastic? Are people saying, yeah, we need something like this?
Absolutely. One of the first things we did when we decided this was our big idea is we wanted to find, number one, people who influenced us, and definitely we felt like they were our elders. Another thing we wanted to do is reach out to people who were doing similar work. They're working with moms or they're working with mothers, teenagers. There was an organization called Small Miracles that was a volunteer-based organization. We wanted to figure out what were the gaps and how could we meet them and how could we give more services to the people.
Tia, can you talk about your experience as a doula and how that fits into all of this?
Absolutely. That's a very loaded question, but I really felt that doula work uniquely positioned me to provide some advocacy and some activism for what we were seeing and hearing in the community and to really elevate the voices of birthing people. And when I was pregnant with my first baby at 18, it was then that I realized I had options about my health care, about my body, about my birth. And I was set on making sure that other women had access to that information. And so all of that coupled with the racial disparities from a place that I'm born and raised in brought me to birth work. And I feel like doula work is a way in which we can begin to change some of that.
And how did you get into this, Tamara?
I started out just as a person in a support group in a circle talking to people about our experiences breastfeeding. The African American Breastfeeding Alliance happened to be a place where I found home. There was a woman there named Hershey Barnett Bridges who mothered me, loved me, and just really brought me along the way. But in that time, I really got activated and I wanted to know more about why these statistics were the way they were. And I felt very much like my sister's keeper. And there's this phrase that we like to use, each one teach one, that if I've been given something and I've got power, I definitely want to feel responsible to pass that on. So here I am.
Tia, this is a question I've asked a lot of people when we're talking about racial disparities in infant mortality, graduation rates, economic outcomes, you name it.
Yep.
The statistics are out there. We all know it. It's gotten national attention. Do you feel like in this community there's an urgency? Like people are like, this is something we got to do something about.
Yes and no. What's interesting is as we go out into the community and try to engage others and pull people together around racial disparities, what we find is that a lot of people aren't even aware that Wisconsin sits where they do in respect to infant mortality, in respect to breastfeeding disparities. And so there is a lack of awareness. And I think what the issue is when we bring up the topic of race, we tend to make people uncomfortable. But what I like to say is that it's racism. And so that's what's driving our disparities. It's not that there's group level flaws. This is a national issue and it's a man-made thing. And so there's a lot of talk around health equity, but we don't see the actions meeting the words. Mm-hmm. And we want to hold people accountable to that.
Tamara, do you see this as something that needs to go on beyond childbirth? And, you know, as kids get older, do you see similar health disparities in the ways kids are treated?
Absolutely. I feel like it starts with birth. We want to make sure we're bringing healthy individuals into the community. But after we pass them off, what are the risk factors for those children? Do they have safe environments? Are their homes well kept? Is there lead in their drinking water? Are they being discriminated against in the education system that they're going to? Are the different things that they're being exposed to, like food deserts, playing a factor into how they go throughout society? Absolutely. There's so many connections and intersections.
Tia, if somebody is out there, either in your local community in the Madison area, thinking, yeah, I want to get involved and help, or elsewhere around the state saying, we need something like this there, can they get involved?
Absolutely. I would encourage them to reach out to us. The African American Breastfeeding Alliance of Dane County, our website is www.latchonaaba.org. And I would encourage them to reach out, send us a message. You can also find Harambe Village on Facebook at Harambe Village. And we would love to connect you and help you get involved.
Mm-hmm. Tamara, looking 5 years, say, into the future, looking back from then, what does success look like to you?
Success for us looks like having a quality, more well, closely knit community. It also looks like having more centers and more connections throughout the community. It also looks like people being able to share their stories in circles. It looks like perhaps something like a birth center. It looks like so much more where we can just create more of a connectivity. You know, the word Harambe means let's pull together. We want to see more people pulling together. Absolutely.
And Tia, what's the next step from where you are now to get to that place?
Well, that's a great question. Really, like we said, to empower individuals and to empower our community, because we need that mobilization to see true change, and we need that buy-in. And it needs to come from the bottom up, because it's not coming from the top down.
We'll leave it there for now. Tia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Tamara, thanks a lot for coming up.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Tia Murray and Tamara Ann Thompson. They are doulas, lactation counselors, and they're the co-founders of the organization Harambe Village in Madison. We've been talking about their effort, their campaign to educate women of color and healthcare providers about the benefits of breastfeeding. And as we've been hearing, to do a lot more than that, too. First, if you've ever been a pedestrian crossing the street, this may have happened to you. And you're not alone. A new study from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee finds that most Milwaukee drivers don't yield to pedestrians in city crosswalks. The study looked at 20 intersections in the city without traffic lights or stop signs. Drivers stopped for pedestrians just 16% of the time. Robert Schneider joins us now. He's an associate professor in the UW-Milwaukee Department of Urban Planning, one of the authors of that study. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks.
Well, this isn't just a Milwaukee problem, I'm guessing, but let's start with the study in Milwaukee. What did you do?
Sure. We investigated the crossings of pedestrians along these main roadways. These are locations with speed limits of 25 to 30 miles an hour, so not the most difficult locations for drivers to yield where there would be higher speed limits. They were also one lane in each direction. Some of the roads had bike lanes, some of them didn't, but one travel lane for cars in each direction. We observed pedestrians crossing as they normally would at 5 to 7 p.m. on weekdays, and observed drivers as they approached the crosswalk after a pedestrian had arrived. And if a driver had sufficient distance prior to the crosswalk, we observed whether or not they yielded to that pedestrian who was attempting to cross. And we found that only in about 1 in 5, 16%, yielded to pedestrians who had entered the crosswalk. Of course, that's citywide across the 20 intersections. We did see quite a range between the locations, from 60% at the highest driver-yielding site to 0% at four locations that had 10 or more crossings during the two-hour period.
And what was it in those sites that had more success, more drivers yielding? Were there common features on them?
Yeah, so when we looked broadly at 364 total yielding opportunities, and the ones that the 60 where drivers did yield out of those total yielding opportunities across our sites, the ones with more yielding had narrower streets, so shorter crossing distances, the slower speed limit, so 25 versus 30. There was generally less traffic on that main roadway. And then pedestrians were more clearly indicating their intent to cross the street, so leaning towards the other side of the street or standing more in the street to make people aware of their crossing intention.
Now let's zoom out here. This is a serious safety issue, right? There are quite a few fatalities each year from a car pedestrian accidents, right?
Yes, in Wisconsin, we average somewhere between 50 and 60 in a typical year. Last year, unfortunately, was over 60. But currently, there's a national trend in pedestrian fatalities that has been a 40% increase between 2009 and 2016, which has gotten us to about 6,000 people killed per year, which is the highest rate of pedestrian fatalities in three decades.
Do we have any idea why that rate, that fatality rate for pedestrians has been going up?
Well, there are a couple of theories. One is that the amount of driving that's gone on nationwide has increased as we've recovered from the recession. So we're seeing that associated with economic activity. We also are seeing an aging of the population overall. But other theories that have been suggested have to do with driver distraction, pedestrian distraction, and just in general, people being out in roadway locations that may not be designed as safely for pedestrians.
Bob Schneider is with us from the UW-Milwaukee Department of Urban Planning talking about pedestrian safety. He did a study and colleagues in Milwaukee finding that many drivers didn't yield to pedestrians when they were supposed to in intersections. And Bob, from what you were saying, I think a lot of people think, oh, this was a distracted pedestrian issue or a bad or discourteous driver issue. It sounds like you're saying this is in large part a design issue. Is that right?
I think there's something very systemic about the issue. There are elements of the roadway design, but also elements of the social norms related to both driving and pedestrians and their expectations to cross the roadway. Specifically, when we found the results that we did, there are certain roadway characteristics that are going to be conducive to crossing, whereas other ones will make it a lot more difficult for drivers to yield, such as having multi-lane roadways. On the social norms side, drivers may not simply be aware that there's a law for yielding the right-of-way to pedestrians in crosswalks. If you've only been introduced to that concept maybe once during driver's ed at age 15 and a half, and then spend, you know, multiple decades after that driving and witnessing how other people around you in the community drive, you may just not realize that that's something that is required by state law. On the other side, pedestrians may have over time learned, you know, we're just going to wave the cars by or wait for a really significant gap in traffic and not even set foot in a crosswalk when, you know, you could potentially do so when you had enough time before a car arrived. So there is a social construction of the interaction between drivers and pedestrians that we see on the roadways now.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page about their experiences driving and walking in their communities. We heard from Amanda, who says she has stopped for pedestrians. So she's driving. She has stopped for pedestrians in well-marked crosswalks with flashing lights and then had cars lay on their horn behind her and whip around her as people are trying to cross in front of her. So there's the norm for drivers, even for a driver trying to stop, the expectation of the driver behind you may not match up with yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that gets to the norm that is there, and there is not a quick solution unless we all get on the same page immediately, and that just doesn't happen in society. So I think we need solutions that take several different tacks, including redesigning our roadways where possible. If there's extra travel lanes where it's easy for somebody to pass around the outside of somebody else who's yielding. This often occurs if there's four or more lanes on a roadway. Maybe some of those roadways don't need to have four lanes and they can just serve traffic sufficiently with two, which would reduce the situation called a multiple threat, which the person on Facebook described. Also, we can have signs like the ones that are put on the center line in crosswalks that say, state law yields to pedestrians. Those are a very effective treatment. And potentially extend the curbs out. So curb bulb outs can reduce crossing distances and reduce the temptation for drivers to swing around the outside of on a roadway. That certainly happens in Milwaukee. On the social side, we also need to think about education and enforcement. So how can we make sure that people are aware that they need to be driving with a consciousness of the need to yield the right-of-way if a pedestrian sets foot in the crosswalk. I guess I'd encourage all the listeners who are in their cars currently to think, you know, if I'm on a street that could potentially have a pedestrian stepping into the crosswalk in several blocks, am I ready to be able to yield to that person? If you take that mindset, you will notice that you change your behavior, and you'll probably find yourself driving slower. So you as a driver, if you're trying to do the right thing, you're going to be driving slower going into the crosswalk, which means the people behind you hopefully are also going to be going slower because of your slower pace. This isn't something natural that we've been taught. We've often learned socially that we should travel 5 or 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, but it does change one by one. It changes through the leadership of professional drivers, including law enforcement, Lyft drivers, bus drivers. They can help set an example that ultimately can permeate through the social norms of drivers' behavior.
Robert Schneider is with us, Associate Professor of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee and an author behind a new study finding that most Milwaukee drivers don't yield to pedestrians. Similar stories elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your experience walking and driving where you live? As a pedestrian, do drivers stop for you? As a driver, do you stop for pedestrians? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about pedestrians, crosswalks, and drivers with Robert Schneider, the author behind a new UW-Milwaukee study. They found that drivers tend not to yield to pedestrians in crosswalks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's it like walking and driving where you live? Do people stop for you when you're crossing the street as a pedestrian? Do you stop for others? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bob is with us now in Richland Center. Bob, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Good. Well, I want to bring up multi-lane crossings for pedestrians, where a pedestrian starts crossing and a vehicle is stopped, but the second vehicle in the next lane over, maybe the left-hand lane, can't see why the first vehicle is stopped, that they've stopped for a pedestrian. And I'm wondering if your guest ran into situations like that and has suggestions on how to correct that, because the second vehicle may not even see the pedestrian crossing in front of the first one.
I see that all the time. Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a situation that is particularly dangerous for pedestrians because the second vehicle in the lane over can be going at a fairly high rate of speed if they're not aware of the need to yield to the pedestrian. Our study didn't specifically look at those cases because we were just looking at one lane in each direction. However, there are some important guidelines to know about. One is that it is state law, if there is a car stopped in an adjacent lane to yield to a pedestrian, that you should not pass that car. So you should be stopping at the crosswalk as well. That's not well known. It's important to educate people about that. There are also some treatments that can be used from the engineering and roadway design side to address that issue. One is rapid flashing beacons. You see these, I know, in Milwaukee and Madison in certain locations that a pedestrian can push the button and the crosswalk sign itself will have some flashers below it that will make drivers more aware that they're crossing at that particular location. Also, a new type of treatment has been developed and tested by Michigan DOT called the Gateway Treatment, where they take the in-road state law yield to pedestrian sign, and they don't just put it at the center of the roadway, they also put it at the curbs of the road so that somebody who might be passing on the right side, for example, will see another yield sign at that point and help be reminded that this could be a location where there's a pedestrian crossing. The last thing is, on some of these higher speed, higher volume roadways that have multiple lanes, there's something called a pedestrian hybrid beacon, which is kind of like its own pedestrian signal, and so if a pedestrian gets detected at that crosswalk, then drivers will be required to stop because the light will ultimately turn red, and it will be just like a regular red traffic light. However, these really are some of the most challenging locations for roadway engineers, as well as others working on safety, to address. That's a great point.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Richard is with us next in Blair. Richard, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I want to relate an instance. There's three things I want to bring up. One, instance in Independence, where 5-6-year-old kids were taught well by their parents to get off their bikes and walk it across the intersection, which was marked. I saw this dump truck coming towards me. I had stopped, put my hands up and waved it. He couldn't have missed it. Expletive deleted guy kept going. Didn't care. In Blair here, I go to cross Highway 95 continually. And the cars, I step into the crosswalk, see 1, 2, 3 paces in it, they just keep going. And they don't slow down.
Richard, your connection isn't great there, but Richard is seeing for kids and for grown-ups like himself, people not pulling over or not stopping.
Yeah, I mean, I've experienced it myself here in Milwaukee. I was trying to cross the street to get from the Pick and Save to a bus stop across the way. I was crossing with an elderly woman who was pushing a grocery cart at the same time, and we waited for probably a dozen cars to whiz by. We were at a crosswalk, very clearly marked, and I had to essentially put my hands out and start waving back and forth to get somebody to stop and eventually help that elderly woman across the street. You know, in doing that, it was just something that I did currently during that day, and I know the caller, you know, has gone through similar experiences to get people safely across the street. But stepping back a little bit from that, you ask, well, what does this say about our community? If we're somebody first visiting Wisconsin or for Milwaukee for the first time, and we're not letting kids cross the street or not letting an elderly woman cross the street with her groceries, what does that say about us as a community? And I think we need to think really carefully about that. What image are we showing through our public spaces and how we interact? It definitely is a safety issue, and Wisconsin DOT and Bureau of Traffic Safety have recognized pedestrian and bicycle safety as a priority area, and so they helped fund the study, and they're helping to ultimately do more education and encourage higher visibility enforcement on this issue. But really, it does speak to who we are as a community.
Thanks for that call, Richard. We're talking to Robert Schneider, professor at the UW-Milwaukee Department of Urban Planning, talking about pedestrian safety in the roadways. He co-wrote a study finding that a lot of Milwaukee drivers didn't stop at crosswalks for pedestrians when they were supposed to. Back to your calls. John is with us in Rice Lake. John, hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I just came back from St. John's, Newfoundland, and I'd spent 5 days there. And the rate at which vehicles would stop for pedestrians had to be in the upper high 90%. And they would not only stop at the crosswalk for people, but if you were anywhere along the street and you looked like you wanted to stop, the vehicles would stop and let you cross. And by the second day I was there, I had a rental. I was doing the same thing. So I'm wondering why in St. John's, Newfoundland, why is it so prevalent that they stop for pedestrians? And I'm wondering if we could learn from them about what they do.
John, thanks. Any thoughts, Bob?
Yeah, that's such a fantastic question, and it's a great example because there was a study done back in the late 80s by one of the leading pedestrian safety researchers in this field, Ron Van Houten, and they looked at three communities in Newfoundland, and I believe St. John's was one of them, where they really put a significant effort into education and enforcement of crosswalk laws in the 80s and saw an increase in driver-yielding behavior and also, very importantly, documented an increase in pedestrian safety. I'll mention that same researcher, Ron Van Houten, also did a study in Gainesville, Florida, recently for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And it was to see how well a high-visibility enforcement effort could work. That involves having the police give out warnings and also work with the local media to spread the word that it's drivers' responsibility to be yielding to pedestrians in crosswalks. And so that combination itself, at their 6 control sites, originally there was a 35% driver yielding rate. They got that up to 70%.
Wow.
In just 1 year. However, they did a 4-year follow-up after that, and this is just from 2016, without much additional enforcement over that 4-year period, yielding had gone up even more to 77%. So if they had actually changed some of the social norms for driving in that community, and that was also associated with a decrease in the pedestrian crash rates.
John, thanks for sharing that experience. We'll go now to Carrie in La Crosse. Carrie, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say I grew up in Milwaukee, and I can definitely reflect back as to what the professor is saying and how it's so hard to cross the street in Milwaukee. You can wait for 10, 12 cars to go by before you can actually cross. And as a driver, I'm a very aggressive driver, and I'm one of those people growing up that I didn't wait for pedestrians. But now I go to university in La Crosse, and my friends and I were joking the other day that we don't even, you know, look at the street anymore. We just start crossing because in the middle of the road, you don't have to be at a crosswalk, just like his experience in Newfoundland was. You don't even be at a crosswalk. People will just stop if they see you next to the road looking to pass. And, like, sometimes they'll even wave the car by to allow them to go because I, you know, have a second. I don't need to cross quite yet. And they'll literally wait until I cross. They won't go. And so it's a totally different feeling all the way across the state in La Crosse than what I grew up in Milwaukee feeling.
Carrie, thanks a lot. I want to jump in and bring Bob in on this. It sounds like from the last couple of callers and what you were just saying, Bob, is that culture matters and some small changes, some small efforts can change that culture.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And looking nationally at it, there's differences within the state and obviously within Milwaukee that between 60% yielding in one place and zero in another. But looking broadly across the nation, we see that some of the highest rates of driver yielding are actually out west, the San Francisco Bay Area, Seattle, northwestern portion of the country, whereas here in the Midwest and further east, generally the cultures are less supportive, or there's fewer drivers who are yielding to pedestrians in these cases. But that can potentially change, as I mentioned from the Gainesville example.
We'll leave it there for now. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
We've been talking to Robert Schneider, associate professor at the UW-Milwaukee Department of Urban Planning, author behind a new study finding that drivers in Milwaukee intersections just yield to pedestrians just 16% of the time. You can still share your thoughts and experiences on a lively conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Mike in Appleton there. Mike says he walks into Appleton every day, and 95% of drivers are courteous. Greg says so few motorists stop for pedestrians in the Madison area that it's confusing and unbelievable when one actually does stop. Again, share your local experiences over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Some news from the world of science. The human body may have a new, previously undiscovered organ. Or it might not. It depends on who you ask. In a new paper, researchers at the New York University School of Medicine shared their discovery of a structure within the human body. It's fluid-filled, interconnected compartments that go all over the place, and they think might be shock absorbers kind of for tissue. They're still figuring out what this does. The tricky thing about them was these are really hard to find because usually the way you take a tissue sample would destroy these little compartments. You wouldn't know they were there. They used a process called probe-based confocal laser endomicroscopy to spot this stuff. I don't know how that works. There are arguments over whether this thing is technically an organ, and it turns out it's really hard to define what an organ is. But I bring it up here and now because of its name. This organ, or not organ, is called the interstitium, meaning a place that's in the midst of other stuff. Why is that interesting? Well, this little mini segment I'm doing right now and do every day on the show, it was originally this little spot in the middle of Central Time where we had to fill this gap, and we called it, it's in the middle of stuff, we called it the interstitial. And we always assumed we'd come up with a better name for it, and what are we, 4.5 years out? We never did. So it's still the interstitial, and now at long last, there's been an interstitial about the interstitium, which may or may not be the newest organ in the human body. This is Central Time.